Bible Worm, Bible Worm, reading the Bible with Bible Worm.
Welcome to Bible Worm, getting to the core of the biblical text. I'm Dr. Amy Robertson, Director of Lifelong Learning at Congregation Or Hadash in Sandy Springs, Georgia.
And I'm Dr. Robert Williamson, Professor of Religious Studies at Hendricks College and the founding pastor of Mercy Community Church in Little Rock. We're here every week to discuss the biblical text, both as biblical scholars and as people of faith, one Jewish and one Christian.
This week, we read Luke chapter 9, verses 28 through 45. As the gospel begins to speak of Jesus' departure, we climb deep into his connection with the folks he meets up on the mountain. Not only to their shared mountain theophanies, but also to the unexpected ways that each of their days on earth came to an end. We feel for the disciples who just can't manage to really take in the world-changing things that they are seeing and hearing. And we can't help but picture the mom from the Goldbergs up there with them, bedazzling Jesus' robe and offering everyone a cheese tray. Thanks for being with us. Hello, Bobby. How are you?
Hey, Amy. I'm doing really well. How are you?
I am doing all right. Well, this week, I want to say this is an entertaining story, but I don't think that's quite accurate. I don't know. Is this story entertaining?
No. I mean, I sort of feel like this is one of those stories that's like, it's kind of the highlight, like, I mean, even like literally in terms of its elevation in the gospel, like this
and
is one of
light.
The...
It's like gleamingness.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. So I think it's meant to be an entertaining story, but I find this story more confusing really than anything. So I'm curious what you're going to have to say about it.
You know, I like a confusing story. It's like a cabinet of curiosities.
Cabinet of curiosities.
Let's open the cabinet of curiosities and see what we have this week.
Okay.
So we are in chapter 9, verse 28 to 45 this week of the book of Luke. Is there anything that you feel like we need to be filled in on from last time? We did skip just a little bit.
A couple of things seem kind of relevant to me. The first one is at the beginning of chapter 9, Jesus sends out the disciples, sort of sends them on a, like on their own experiential learning adventure and gives them authority. And part of that authority is that Jesus gives them the power over all demons and to heal sickness. So Jesus has sort of bestowed on the disciples this particular power, which is going to become relevant later in our conversation. And then Jesus feeds the 5,000 with the miraculous, you know, feeding of the bread and the fish. Mm. And after that, the disciples figure out, Jesus says, who do you say that I am? And Peter says, you're the Christ sent from God. And so the disciples at this
point... That is important, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So the disciples at this point in the gospel have seen this, you know, they've seen Jesus doing his miracles until they finally make this declaration about him. And this text that we're about to read today follows immediately on that story where they're struggling with their insight that Jesus is the Messiah.
Yeah. Oh, that was important catch up. I'm glad you did that.
Yeah.
I'm glad you did that. Okay. So should I just go ahead and dive in?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. So we're picking up at verse 28. Now, about 8 days after these sayings, Jesus took with him Peter and John and James and went up on the mountain to pray. And while he was praying, the appearance of his face changed and his clothes became dazzling white. Suddenly they saw two men, Moses and Elijah, talking to him. They appeared in glory and were speaking of his departure, which he was about to accomplish at Jerusalem. Now Peter and his companions were weighed down with sleep, but since they had stayed awake, they saw his glory and the two men who stood with him. I can't help but think about, like, you know those, you can buy them still at, like, Michael's, like, bedazzlers, you can bedazzle things. That's here, in the biblical text.
Jesus is bedazzling white.
He has a bedazzled robe.
Do you watch the Goldbergs? That makes me think of Beverly Goldberg, who likes to bedazzle
She
things.
Likes to bedazzle everything.
She does.
That's right.
This would be such a more, like, entertaining story if this was Moses, Elijah, and Beverly Goldberg.
Like, and she's, like, bedazzling
everybody.
His robe while he's talking to Moses.
Yeah, and... I love that image.
So I feel like the you know, $50,000 question in this chunk of text for me is, why Moses and Elijah?
I mean, so a couple of sort of, you know, fairly easy gets in that conversation is, you know, both Moses and Elijah have mountaintop experiences mm-hmm. where they encounter God. Moses, of course, on Sinai for a very long time. Elijah in 1 Kings 19, when he flees away from Ahab and Jezebel, ends up at Sinai or Horeb and meets God there, and God sends him back to the city. So in my mind, like Jesus on a mountain, Moses on a mountain, Elijah's on a mountain, they're mm-hmm. all being connected in that kind of a way. Mm-hmm. And then the other sort of clear resonance is Moses, I think, represents Torah. Elijah represents prophecy. Jesus being there with both those representatives sort of suggests that Jesus is in line with, continuous with, culmination of, however you want, whatever verb fits there of those two parts of scripture. He's not something new and different. He's something that belongs. I mean, he is new and different, but not wholly different. He belongs with those two.
He's in a lineage, yeah. Mm-hmm.
What other kinds of resonances do you see with Moses?
I mean, the resonance that I have been studying with one of my bat mitzvah students, one of the last parshas in Deuteronomy, one of the last sections of the book of Deuteronomy called Ha'azinu, where it's right before Moses's death. And he goes up to another mountain, Mount Nebo, and looks out over the land of Israel. And like, I mean, Moses dies. Moses leads his people up to the next chapter in their relationship with God, but he can't be there with them for it.
Yeah.
It's a heart-wrenching scene on the mountain. Like, he pleads with God to be able to enter the land of Israel after having led the people through all their ridiculousness, like all that mishigas, getting them out of Egypt and through the desert and through their complaining and, you know. And so there's this moment, like this mountaintop moment for Moses where he learns how he's going to die.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of what's happening here too.
Yeah, I love that. That's really interesting. I'd not made that connection, but that's exactly right. Luke gives us that detail, which we don't get in Mark's version of the story, that what they were talking about was Jesus's departure, which he would achieve in Jerusalem.
What a euphemism.
I know. the word there in Greek actually is Exodus, which is a really strong connection, of course, to the Moses story. And so Jesus's crucifixion, resurrection, and ascension, I think, is what's being talked about there, is being framed as an Exodus, connecting to Moses crossing the Red Sea and escaping from Pharaoh. But I love what you're doing with that. Jesus is also learning like that the nature of Jesus's exodus is that it involves his death, and which is a really interesting connection to the Moses story. And so Jesus is on this mountain thinking about his future with the people who are going to carry his legacy forward. And he's kind of, I mean, we don't really get Jesus's emotional state here other than he's up on a mountain and he's praying, which Jesus tends to do when he's troubled in some kind of a way.
Yeah, I mean, both Moses and Jesus are really trying to lead the people through a completely world-changing situation, you know, and try to help them to understand something that is really outside their experience. And it's the people, it's a really hard job, and the people don't understand. And both Moses and Jesus, I think, struggle a lot with that leadership role and how frustrating it is to talk to a people that they just don't understand your words.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One of the things that's unusual or different about Luke's account of this story is that it happens when Jesus is in prayer. In the other gospels, Jesus is just up on the mountain and Moses and Elijah kind of show up. Here, Jesus is specifically, he's praying, and they show up while he is in his prayer state. And so we've seen Jesus praying previously. His experience of the baptism in Luke's gospel was a prayer experience where the heavens opened and Jesus said, "You're my son with whom I am well pleased." Mm-hmm. Jesus prayed, went on the mountain and prayed before he chose his disciples. Now here's Jesus up on the mountain praying when Moses and Elijah show up to him. Mm-hmm. I don't really know what to say about that other than Luke is really emphasizing the importance of prayer and that prayer punctuates this gospel at like key moments where something about Jesus's identity or something about his followers happens. Prayerfulness is very much a part of the narrative.
Yeah, and you're talking about it in that way really underscores for me the, I don't know, importance or strangeness or both, that there are witnesses to this.
Yeah.
And they see the guys too. They see Elijah and Moses. So it's not just an internal experience
that's right.
Jesus is having. It's This is actually happening.
Yeah, it's actually happening while Jesus is praying. Like, it's kind of an interesting, yeah, kind of an interesting set of things.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's so interesting that notice in 32 that Peter and James and John were almost asleep. And then, like, this crazy thing happens and they manage to stay awake. I'm like, I feel like, wouldn't you be like, ho, 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 like, I know. You know, like, sit bolt upright, like, oh my God, what is happening? But they're like, oh, just struggling to keep their eyes open.
I was talking to my husband last night and told him this is the text we were reading today. And he pulled it up. He's a lapsed Episcopalian. And so he pulled up the text and whatever translation he was reading to me just said, they were very sleepy. It's so funny.
Very sleepy.
But I love that detail. Like, it's so real. Like, they don't know what's going on. It's like being dragged around by your parents when you're a little kid. And your parent understands why this thing you're doing is important, but they're tired, man.
Yeah.
Do you think they're brought up there so that they will see? Or does Jesus want company?
Yeah, because, I mean, the verb there is, he took Peter, James, and John.
Yeah.
So
it's intentional.
It's intentional. And we've had other places where Jesus withdraws by himself.
Yeah.
So it seems to me like he has wanted them there either to experience this thing with him. He knew this is what was going to happen, or because he wanted company. And I don't know which one of those.
I have this one other thought about Moses, especially Moses, less so Elijah being there. But I keep thinking about, like, why couldn't God just tell Jesus about his departure? Like, why are Moses and Elijah there for our benefit, or to like help us connect the story of Jesus to the story of Moses? Or are they there for Jesus's benefit? I don't know. It has me thinking about like the nature of how Jesus will depart is fairly new information as far as we know, and kind of traumatic information, I would imagine, for Jesus himself. And so I could see how, I don't know, like, I'm thinking of like trauma support groups where people who have been through rough things are able to, I don't know, guide you through thinking about it in a different way, in a way that's like really real and acknowledges how bad it is, but also can be encouraging. Not that Moses's death is just like Jesus's. I mean, it's not, but Moses' death is rough.
And Elijah just gets taken up into heaven in a chariot.
I know.
Like, he didn't even know. He's like, I don't know what you guys are talking about.
I've been riding around in a chariot all these years.
I guess Jesus is going to have that experience too. That's kind of interesting. Yeah. He's going to die in the way that Moses died, and he's going to be taken up into heaven in the way that Elijah was taken up into heaven. And so he needs both of them in order to sort of understand this full experience that's coming.
Yeah.
So you're right. Jesus has told the disciples just right before this, and the 8 days earlier, he has announced to them that he's going to be killed and raised on the third day in 9:21-22. And they don't understand. And so part of the gospel, the rest of the gospel, is them trying to come to terms with what Jesus has told them. And so I really like what you're saying about Jesus needs somebody who he doesn't have to like talk through it himself. He needs somebody who can sort of be with him through it. And the Moses and Elijah are those people. I really love that way of reading it.
It's like the very human side of, it's a very human reading of Jesus.
Yeah, no, I like that. We should probably talk just a little bit about, like, Jesus, this passage is often talked about as the transfiguration of Jesus, which is a reference, I mean, to the whole story, but specifically to that change of his appearance. But I'm just curious if you have thoughts about, like, you know, the change of his appearance, the flashing of his clothes, the whiteness of his presence. Like, any thoughts about why that might be significant?
So going back to Moses, it ties into Exodus 34, where Moses encounters God. And then it's like his being so close to the glory of God, his face picks up this radiance of its own. And the text tells us that when he goes back down to talk to the people, they can't look at him because he's so bright. So he has to wear like a little veil. Because they won't look at him. And I just will put a little note in here. I hope this story sounds completely ridiculous to our listeners, but because people still believe it, I feel like I need to say it. This word for radiance that's associated with Moses was translated into the Latin as, instead of saying Moses, like his face radiated, that he had horns.
Yeah.
And I actually know several Jews who have either been asked point blank where their horns are, or people who went to like college or summer camp and someone asked if they could wash their hair for them as though it was like this sweet and bizarrely intimate gesture because they wanted to see if they had horns.
What?
Jews do not have horns, people. Just radiance.
Just radiance.
No, just Moses and Jesus had the radiance.
Yeah.
All right. So let's see what happens next, shall we?
Let's do it.
Okay. So picking up in verse 33. Just as they were leaving him, Peter said to Jesus, Master, it is good for us to be here. Let us make three dwellings, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah, not knowing what he said. While he was saying this, a cloud came and overshadowed them, and they were terrified as they entered the cloud. Then from the cloud came a voice that said, This is my son, my chosen. Listen to him. When the voice had spoken, Jesus was found alone. And they kept silent and in those days told no one any of the things they had seen.
Mm-hmm.
Man, those apostles are really disoriented.
Yeah, you feel for them, right? Like they're having this experience that's totally outside of anything they have any categories for.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't know what to do with it. And so Peter is really trying, I think, to do the right thing by way of, you know, you're there. Can you imagine, you know, you're on a mountain and you're suddenly there with Moses and Elijah and then Jesus that you've been walking around with for, you know, 6 months or whatever is like bedazzled.
Uh-huh.
And you wouldn't know. Like we tend to read Peter as like, oh, Peter. But I'm like, the fact that Peter even like had a thought about anything to do in this moment is kind of remarkable.
And it's very much connected to the Goldbergs. Like, isn't that what they would do? They'd be like, I'm going to get you a cheese tray.
Yeah.
That's what we're going to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Peter does, to his credit, I think, recognize a little bit of what's happening. He knows it's Moses and Elijah. I don't know how he knows that.
Yeah.
But yeah, he doesn't understand, which, I mean, how would he?
Like, Luke is very specific there. He didn't know what he was saying. Right? This was not the right thing to have said.
That is correct.
But I'm curious, but why is it not the right thing to have said? Do you have thoughts about what Peter's idea about to build these shrines? Like, in what way was that the wrong thing to say? Do you know? Do you have a thought?
My thought on this is your thought from the last time we talked about this text. Because it really made a strong impression on me, this idea that he thinks they're going to stay. He's like, great, let's all stay. Let's stay here. Although, I mean, he makes them sort of temporary dwellings, but he doesn't seem to understand that this is like a revelation that's happening here. And it's exceedingly temporary.
Yeah.
And they don't really have the bodily needs that he might have.
Yeah, I think that's a good reading of this text. Wait, that was what I said last week.
Yeah. It was a good reading of the text.
Nice job.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because, you know, it is true that so Moses is up on Sinai, but he doesn't stay up there. He has to come back down to the people, and that's a total mess. And then Elijah is running away from people who are trying to kill him, and God says, you can't stay here. You got to go back. And mm-hmm. so I do think there is something here about mountains are temporary, and they're important. You have special experiences there, but you can't stay on them.
Yeah, but to his credit, I mean, it does seem like Peter is trying to be hospitable or offer them what he can imagine from his own experience they might want.
Yeah.
But it is not what they want.
No, it is not what they want. So we get a cloud here overshadowing them. Mm-hmm. I know that's a familiar idea from the Hebrew Bible. Can you, like, what does that
connect? I mean, it just puts us right back in the book of Exodus, like when they're... The strongest resonance for me is the stories of moving through the desert. And when it's time for them to sort of settle down and stay in a place for a while, it says a cloud descends upon the tabernacle and they stay. And then the cloud sort of lifts and they know it's time to move again. So the cloud is a indication of God's especially present presence.
So when the cloud descends here, we would sort of think about that as like now God is like, now it's Moses, Elijah, Jesus, and God.
Yeah.
Sort of in a different kind of way.
Yes.
Like God is like present. Yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
That's intense.
I mean, and they're terrified.
Yeah. Which is the appropriate response, right?
This is the appropriate response. It is not, I'm going to build you a sukkah. It's, I'm going to be
terrified.
I'm going to be terrified.
Yeah.
And then when the voice comes from the cloud, what do you think about what it's says. I mean, I guess listen to him.
Yeah.
Sounds to me like scolding.
Yeah.
But aren't they trying to listen to him? Like, they are listening to him. They're trying to listen to him.
Yeah. I mean, to me, that's a little bit of that, like, do you ever have conversations with people where you're like, you're not listening to me? And they're like, yeah. I heard every word you said.
Yeah.
And I'm like, yeah, but you didn't, yeah. you didn't listen to me though, did you? And so there's, you get this sort of like, we hear you, but we don't, like, there's a disconnect in that processing.
Yeah.
That's, I mean, to me, that's sort of what's happening here. Like, the disciples are hearing Jesus. They're saying some of the right things, like, you're the Messiah. Jesus mm-hmm. says, that means I'm going to suffer and die. They can't take that on board.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's this sort of like, there's a limit to their listening.
Yeah.
Or at least they're comprehending. And so maybe this yeah. voice is saying, you gotta push through. Like, this thing that is happening, you do not have categories for this thing in your own head.
Yes. Yes.
And so you gotta like let go of some stuff and just really pay attention.
Yeah. No, I love the way you just said that you don't have categories for this in your head. So it's much more nuanced than obey him, you know?
Yeah.
Like they are pretty much obeying him, but it's like soak yourself in his words. Like, yeah, really try to, as you said, like take it on board, and it's gonna be totally outside the categories of existence that you have known.
Yeah. I think that's right. The other connection that probably you would make is that what the voice says here is quite similar to what the voice said to Jesus at the baptism, when Jesus was praying
That's
at the
right.
baptism.
That's
this is
right.
my son with you are my son with whom I am well pleased.
Mm-hmm.
So here we get that reiteration, but this time publicly an announcement. This is my son.
Mm-hmm.
And then instead of with whom I am well pleased, you get the command, listen to him. So I think we're meant to hear that baptism is sort of setting apart this new part of Jesus's ministry. And then I think we're now the transfiguration is sort of setting apart the next thing that's about to happen. It's like it's a marking of important transitions, I think.
All right. So now we're going to come back down the mountain.
Yeah.
Picking up in verse 37. On the next day, when they had come down from the mountain, a great crowd met him. Just then, a man from the crowd shouted, "Teacher, I beg you to look at my son. He is my only child." Suddenly, a spirit seizes him, and all at once he shrieks. It convulses him until he foams at the mouth. It mauls him and will scarcely leave him. "I begged your disciples to cast it out, but they could not." Jesus answered, "You faithless and perverse generation, how much longer must I be with you and bear with you? Bring your son here." While he was coming, the demon dashed him to the ground in convulsions. But Jesus rebuked the unclean spirit, healed the boy, and gave him back to his father. And all were astounded at the greatness of God. That's an intense story.
That is an intense story. Yeah.
What details stand out to you about this situation?
The first thing I think is earlier in the podcast, I was talking about how the disciples received from Jesus the authority to cast out
yeah.
demons back in
yeah.
9:2. And yeah. here what we have is kind of a test of that authority. Can they do it? And they can't.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's this kind of interesting, this is a source of frustration for Jesus, right? Who calls them a faithless and crooked generation. At least I think he's talking to the disciples there. It's not entirely clear. But he's like, I gave you this authority. You ought to be able to do this thing. You are not able to do it. And so there's this kind of miscarriage of this apostolic calling where Jesus has said, you're my folks and I'm going to give you my power. And
yeah.
this thing that you're talking about where you're on the mountain, you're thinking about what's going to happen after I'm gone. And when the people pass into the next stage of the ministry, how's it going to go? And here's the disciples not able to do what Jesus has given them the authority to do.
Mm-hmm.
And how disappointing that must be for him. I mean, like his response here is pretty harsh.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of it, is he's worried about what happens when I'm not here anymore.
But these words, faithless generation, also harken back to Deuteronomy 32. Like Moses says to the people in that very same parsha, he calls them that crooked, perverse generation.
Mm.
And there really is that sense in reading Moses there and reading Jesus here that like, y'all, I am leaving soon. You have
yeah.
got to get yourselves together.
Yeah.
It just feels like such a quick like flip of the switch here in this text. But again, like this revelation of Jesus's departure is recent.
Yeah, this part of the text is so interesting, and like the there's intense things happening in like all sorts of different registers. So like,
yeah.
you know, in the last chapter, they have declared Jesus as the Messiah. They've not been able to understand that he's going to suffer and die. They've encountered Moses and Elijah on a mountain. Mm-hmm. They've been unable to cast out a demon. It's like these high highs and these low lows, and they're all coming together in this kind of like, you just, as you get the sense that everybody's sort of overwhelmed by everything that's sort of coming at them all of a sudden.
Had the disciples done other healing before? Like, are you surprised they couldn't heal this guy?
You know, in my mind, it's not that surprising. Mm-hmm. They get sent out in chapter 9, and the feeding of the 5,000, Jesus says, hey, why don't you feed these 5,000 people? And they're like, we don't have any food. You know, like, they have not sort of risen to the occasion.
Yeah. Let me tell you where my thinking went reading this particular story.
Yeah.
I was thinking about why the disciples couldn't do it.
Mm. Yeah.
And the thought I had was that this sounds so terrifying.
Yeah.
Like this, there is tremendous suffering being described here. And it's just really hard as a human when you encounter someone who is suffering in that way, not to sort of step into that suffering yourself in a way, like not to feel that the best and most empathetic thing you can do is to, you know, is to really inhabit that suffering with the person in some way, to take on the emotional burden of it, when the reality is that doing that doesn't necessarily help.
Yeah.
You know, like there has to be some kind of in between where you can have empathy, but not so lose your footing that you're able to use the power that you do have to be able to help.
I think that's really interesting, because the disciples do have this power, but it's a strange power to have, right?
Like,
this is not a power that regular folks have. You know, we've seen other prophets in the Hebrew Bible and now Jesus who have the capacity to do things like this, but not, you know, just like people who sort of randomly started following Jesus and we're just kind of regular folks. And so, so that trusting in the power that you do have, that it is sufficient and that it's actually there. Mm-hmm. And I like what you're saying about the tendency to get overwhelmed by other people's suffering and to get pulled into it in a way that maybe you don't recognize the power that you actually have. Mm-hmm. I think that's a very empathetic reading of the disciples. And I like that. Like, I can relate to that reading of them. Certainly there are places where I get pulled in, where I could do something, but I'm not confident I could do it. And it's easier for me to sort of get swept up in the problem.
Yeah, there's a saying in the Talmud, don't be daunted by the enormity of the world's grief. Mm-hmm. That I can imagine in this situation being daunted by the enormity of the suffering that was before you.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I will pick up then and take us to the end. I'm actually starting in the middle of verse 43. While everyone was amazed at all that he was doing, he said to his disciples, let these words sink into your ears. The Son of Man is going to be betrayed into human hands. But they did not understand this saying. Its meaning was concealed from them so that they could not perceive it. And they were afraid to ask him about this saying.
Yeah.
Let these words sink into your ears. I mean, that just totally goes back to what you were saying when we said, like, what does it mean? This is my son. Listen to him. They're trying to listen to him.
Yeah.
But like, it's more than that. It's a different, you know, range of meaning for listen.
Yeah, I think that's right. They are hearing him, but they are not hearing him. Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the things that's striking to me is just the continuation of all this stuff, right? You get the sense. So there's been an 8-day break at the beginning of this text, but then you get the sense that like they go up the mountain and this thing happens. And as soon as they get back down the mountain, then you have this healing of this boy. And then as soon as that's over, then now they're thinking about Jesus being handed over into human hands.
Yeah.
And just like it all just comes.
Yes.
With no time to process.
Yes.
Really. And then the instruction is like, let this sink in, right?
Right.
And you're like, how can I let this sink in when it's just like coming at me so fast? Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think Jesus wants them to know that he will be betrayed into human hands?
That's a great question. Because you've got these, like in both of these stories, sets of stories that we've read, you've got the combination of Jesus's glory and then this conversation about his death. And so you're at the high and the low at the same time. And it's important to Jesus that you be able to deal with both of those things, it seems like, at the same time. Mm-hmm. there's kind of two ways that I'm putting that together, and I'm not sure which one or whether either one of these is the right way to put it together. One is that in the big picture of this gospel, what's about to happen is that Jesus's full glory is going to be revealed in the worst thing that happens to him. So his crucifixion and resurrection, that's going to be where you really understand what Jesus is about. And you need to get prepared that you can handle both of those things. Like, this is a little tiny version of what's coming down the road. And when we get there, you need to be able to deal with that. So I need you to start dealing with it now. Mm-hmm. The other way that I'm thinking about it is related to what we were saying before, which is Jesus trying to hand on his ministry to his apostles. And this is going to be their reality too, that this power that they have from God is going to come with persecution from the authorities who can't handle the inbreaking of this kingdom. And so this thing that's happening to me is going to also happen to you. And so I need you to understand that that's where we're headed. Mm-hmm. Do you have thoughts about either what I've said there or your own way of answering that question?
You know, humans expect success to look a certain way.
Yeah.
You know, and so maybe there's some worry that, I mean, understandably coming from what the Hebrew Bible expects from a Messiah, what the Jewish community at this point expects from a Messiah, if you see the way that Jesus's departure goes,
yeah,
it could seem to be undermining the power that you thought you saw before. Like it,
yeah,
it could itself rewrite the story in your head and say, well, that couldn't have been what we thought it was. So maybe planting this seed is saying like, this is, I don't know, maybe it would help to counterbalance at that moment. As you said, like both of these extremes are going to be held together, and like, remember that for later, even if you don't understand what I'm saying now, if you can hold on to this thought for later when these questions will arise.
I love that. So if you can only recognize me in the glorious moments, then at the end of this story, you're going to not know who.
You're not going to recognize me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love that.
All right. So as we come to an end of this section of text, what message would you pull out for folks today?
I think that I am kind of where we just ended up, actually, is a pretty good place to dig into this text, which is, I mean, there's a lot of glorious things that happen in this text. There's the revealing of Moses and Elijah. There's Jesus's transformation. There's the healing of this boy. But these are paired with this lack of understanding and this repetition about suffering. And just where we were there, where you're thinking the gospel, the reality of God, the story about Jesus is not simply in the glorious things, but is also in the misunderstandings and the failures. And that just because you see misunderstandings and failures does not mean that you're not seeing God's glory being worked out in your presence. Mm-hmm. It's easy to see it on top of the mountain. It's easy to see it in the healing. It's really hard to see it in the disciples' failure to carry through. It's really hard to see it in Jesus's description of his suffering and death at the hands of the imperial power. And so if followers of this gospel are only able to see God at work in glorious moments, this is not sufficient to the life of faith. Mm-hmm. You have got to be able to recognize that God is at work among us, even when we fall short. We don't understand. We cannot hear. We can't talk about it. We can't take it on board. We can't do it. Jesus is crucified. In those things, that's when we most need to be aware that God is at work in the world. And in this cultural moment where, I mean, things seem to have been falling apart for a very long time. In my own experience, they seem to be falling apart in a more pronounced or obvious way right now. And that may say something about who I am and the way that I'm privileged to exist in the world. But one would not likely talk about this time as a time when God's glory is like immediately present in the world. And so that sort of insight or that persistence or that stamina to believe that God's work is actually unfolding in the world and to participate in that unfolding, even though right now it looks like misunderstanding and failure, that seems to be an important takeaway from this text for me.
That's really beautiful and really important, I want to say, for our moment. I'm sure many generations have felt that way also.
Yeah, but absolutely.
Yeah. No, I think that's really beautiful.
What are you seeing when you look at this text?
I think not so different from what you said. I am seeing these breakthrough moments of like something so phenomenal happening, so shocking, whether it's good shocking or bad shocking, that don't fit with the weight of your experience in the world. What do we do with those? Like, it's really easy for humans to just sort of tuck those away and be like, well, that didn't really happen. Or, yeah. You know, like that couldn't have happened. That doesn't fit with my experience. It doesn't really make sense. I mean, right now my mind is going to like Holocaust denial. Like it seems so crazy. How could that have happened?
Yeah.
And that's why there's so much, you know, education that like, no, that like those kinds of things, good and bad, do happen.
Yeah.
But it is hard for humans to take that into their worldview, those sort of like potentially life-changing events and moments. And I'm thinking of this course I took in graduate school that was called like Introduction to the Quran or something. And I had no other exposure to the Quran or really to Islam. And I just spent the first month of the class like banging my head against the wall. Like, I don't understand. I don't understand. And finally, the teacher said something like, then let it wash over you.
Mm.
Like, just let it keep washing over you and stop feeling like you have to manipulate every new piece of information you get.
Mm.
But that doesn't mean that you have to refuse it either. And so I don't know, I see that sort of at work in this text too, as we read this extended story, because as you said, like the disciples don't understand right away, and it makes it a longer story. You know, we have more sort of moments like that in the text. And I don't know, it's just interesting for me to think about how people in this text and how people in our world try to interact with information that seems that they don't have any categories for.
I love that. And it's just reminding me of, you know, this story starts out with Jesus in prayer, as happens a lot in this gospel. And that's sort of like, we often think you do need to immediately know how to manipulate or respond to or act in your current situation. But that washing over you sometimes is what you need. And here Jesus is doing that prayerfully,
mm-hmm.
and purposefully. And, you know, it leads him to actions. But there is that moment, even for Jesus in this gospel, of things are happening to him. He needs time to process them. He takes mm-hmm. the time before he acts.
Yeah, and it's so interesting then to think back to how, like, Jesus doesn't say anything on the mountain.
Yeah.
And Peter's so eager to do something, which is, it's not that it's inherently bad. It's just there's not that ability at that time to just take it in.
Well, Amy, next time we are going to have a special Ash Wednesday episode, reading 9:51 to 62, where we're going to be thinking more about what it means in Luke's gospel to be a follower of Jesus. And it is complicated.
I don't doubt it. Well, I look forward to that. I will talk to you again soon.
All right. See you then.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of Bible Worm. If you'd like to hear the rest of our conversation about this text, join our Patreon at the Extended Worm level or higher to get access to extended episodes. You'll also find other goodies like early access, video lectures, weekly liturgies, and more, starting at just $4 per month. Visit patreon.com/BibleWormPodcast for details.
Bible Worm is produced by Bobby Williamson and edited by Joel and Laura Becker. Our theme song is sung by Colin Bagby. We're grateful to all our supporters for helping us to keep the podcast going. A special thank you to our executive producer, Fox Valley Presbyterian Church in Geneva, Illinois, and to our newest sponsor, David Brandfass.
Later this week, look for our special Ash Wednesday episode, where we'll be discussing Jesus' turn to Jerusalem in Luke chapter 9, verses 41 to 52. Until then, keep on digging.